Our third case of the day is number 054736, Clyde B. Williams against Brian Bartow. Mr. Deutsch.
Your Honors, my name is Richard Deutsch. I'm an attorney in the Houston office of Mayor Brown, Rowe, and Ma. I represent the appellant in this case, Clyde B. Williams. The issue before the court this morning is vindictive prosecution. Now, plea bargaining is a common occurrence in today's system, and it's not unusual during plea bargaining for a prosecutor to post threats to a defendant that higher and more severe charges with severe penalties will be brought if a deal is not struck. However, when such threats occur on the heels of a defendant exercising his right to a new trial, and the threats apply to allegations that occur 10 years in the past that are now cold, a presumption of vindictiveness may arise. And that is what has occurred here. Mr. Williams exercised his right to an appeal after his 1997 conviction, and he was granted a new trial. The state then threatened Mr. Williams, telling him that if he did not accept their latest offer, they would charge him with charges that related to crime, to allegations that occurred 10 years in the past but had since gone cold. Mr. Williams stood by his right to a new trial. 10 days later, the state brought the new charges. Mr. Williams was subsequently found guilty of all charges. Now, the State Court of Appeals ruled that prosecutorial vindictiveness did not play a role in this case. Its decision was not only wrong, but it was unreasonable. First, the Court of Appeals refused to extend the correct governing legal principle to the new context where it should apply. In other words, in this case, the Appeals Court refused to apply the legal principles of Blackledge and Thigpen to Williams. The core principle in both Blackledge and Thigpen is that the state cannot retaliate for a defendant's exercise of his right to an appeal. The court refused to apply the principle from those cases to Williams because on the basis that they were distinguishable from Williams' case. In Blackledge and Thigpen, the additional charges were related to the same incident as the initial conviction. In Williams, the additional charges were not related to the incident that surrounded the 1997 conviction. However, in Williams, the prosecutor made the link between the original allegations and the incidents that related to the conviction when he brought those allegations into the threat. In other words, he provided that link between the allegations and the incidents that occurred in the 1997 conviction. By doing so, the practical effect was to put Mr. Williams in the exact same spot as the defendants in Williams and Blackledge.
Are you talking about the link because they were other act witnesses in the second trial that I believe was overturned for ineffective assistance? Am I correct in that?
There were the sisters who were part of the original allegations were eventually used as prior bad acts witnesses in the 1997 conviction, and the trial ended in a conviction. But
the subsequent prosecutor then looked at their testimony and thought they would be viable witnesses, and therefore that case that I guess earlier was determined they weren't good witnesses, they were too young, now they apparently were able to testify. What I think you've already acknowledged is a more serious case.
Correct.
So is that what you're talking about, the link? Because they used them in that trial?
I'm referring to a little bit before that. The link is that during the plea bargaining, when the state made its threat and said, we're going to bring in those additional charges if you don't accept our latest offer, that by doing that, they created the link between the original charges. Created the relation between an original charges and the other charges.
At what stage was that?
That was right. The offer was made 3 years after the 1997 conviction, after the state had tried to appeal the to appeal Mr. Williams, the decision that granted Williams a new trial, but that appeal failed because of an untimely filing.
And was it after the second trial that was reversed?
Correct.
So is it between the second and third
well, and fourth? Well, the final trial, between the final trial in which he was found guilty.
Yeah, so that, okay. New prosecutor, too, wasn't it?
Correct. So the new prosecutor had not actually seen the girls testify.
Just read them.
He had just read it, correct.
Mm-hmm.
So my point there is that Mr. Williams was placed in the exact same situation as the defendants in Black Legend Thigpen. Furthermore, considering the state's concern with prosecutorial vindictiveness, I mean, their main concern is the chilling effect it would have. There's a fear, as they stated in Blackledge, the fear of such vindictiveness may unconstitutionally deter a defendant's exercise of the right to appeal or collaterally attack his first conviction. Well, now that Williams is placed in the same situation as Blackledge and Thigpen, there's really no practical consideration not to apply the principles of Blackledge and Thigpen to Mr. Williams. Furthermore, the state applied the wrong rule to decide a question of law. In this case, the Court of Appeals relied on Bordenkercher, but that's the wrong law, and that is because Bordenkercher does deal with plea negotiations, and it does deal with the threat of additional charges. However, Bordenkercher deals with your everyday run-of-the-mill plea talks before trial. Basically, this occurred right after the indictment. Bordenkercher did, unlike Williams, the threats in Bordenkercher did not come after a conviction had been overturned. They did not come after the defendant had exercised his right to a new trial. And the threats in Bordenkercher did not rely to allegations that were 10 years old and had since gone cold. And furthermore, it's important to point out that none of the Supreme Court cases, whether it be Blackledger, Thigpen, or Bordenkercher, none of them preclude the unusual situation of Williams. None of them say that this cannot apply to the situation that Williams was in, where the threats and the additional charges occurred after he had exercised his right to a new trial. In this case, a presumption of vindictiveness arose when the state tacked on the additional charges after Williams stood by his right to trial. For cases involving vindictive prosecution, the Supreme Court looks at whether there was a realistic likelihood under the circumstances for vindictiveness to arise. In this situation, when the state brought the additional charges in 2000, the circumstances were ripe for a presumption to arise. The state was struggling to prosecute Williams at this point. Typhonia's testimony had not been very strong. In fact, up to that point, she had not been able to actually testify about the supposed assault. When the state did get its conviction in 1997, it was reversed due to ineffective assistance of counsel. As I said before, the state's subsequent appeal also failed due to an untimely notice. Now it's 2000, and the state is no closer to prosecuting Williams. And this has become especially difficult because Williams will not accept the state's plea offers. So in July of 2000, the state is so concerned that it informs Williams that if he does not accept their latest offer, they will then add additional charges for the allegations made 10 years ago. Williams refused. As I said before, 10 days later, new charges were brought. He was found guilty of all charges. The presumption arose in this situation mainly because the state had no other reason to add these charges. No new evidence had arisen regarding the 1990 allegations from the time they were first made to the time they were added in 2000. The state had seen the investigation report in 1990 from those allegations, but it did not bring charges then. As we discussed, the state had heard the sister's testimony in 1997, but did not bring charges at that time. In summary, the case they had against Williams in 2000 was the exact same case they had against him back in 1990. The only difference in 2000 was that Williams had exercised his constitutional right. The Supreme Court has ruled that this presumption is rebuttable, and the state had ample opportunity to do so. But the only explanation proffered by the state was that it now believed it could prove its case against Williams. The state offered no explanation related to any new evidence or anything else that would make their case stronger today than it would have been in 1990. Therefore, a presumption has arisen and the state did not rebut it. The addition of charges for the sisters' allegations was unconstitutional. The resulting convictions for those charges cannot stand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Mr. Gingsner.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is William Gansner, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, representing the respondent in this case. Mr. Deutsch has argued solely on the question of vindictive prosecution in this case.
Excuse me for a minute.
Yes.
Putting aside the discussion of the habeas standard for just a moment, there,
yes.
I was confused about one item in the record.
Yes.
Your brief stated that the circuit court had instructed the defense counsel that the admissibility of any evidence of other sexual conduct by any witness must be raised for hearing outside the presence of the jury. But was Thomas White, about whom that infamous question was asked, was he a witness in the trial?
Yes, I believe he was, Your Honor. And it was understood by the parties at the time as well that any allegation or any reference to other sexual acts should be the subject, other than those charged, should be the subject of a pretrial inquiry and a determination as to whether or not that evidence should be admissible. And the parties understood from the start, and I think it was clear throughout this case, that everyone understood that that admonition would apply to any reference to any other acts evidence.
It was his girlfriend, wasn't it, the victim's mother, who was on the stand at the time?
And she was asked, that's right, and she was asked the question as to, that the court subsequently ruled was highly improper, as to whether or not she was aware that Thomas White, her boyfriend, the caretaker, had engaged in any acts of sexual misconduct with other people in the past. And the defense counsel outside this question was asked in front of the jury. The parties all understood at the time that this was a violation of the court's prior admonition that the parties should not refer to any other acts of sexual misconduct without a pretrial determination of the admissibility. In this highly charged atmosphere, in a child sexual assault prosecution, the parties clearly understood that any reference to any sexual acts of sexual misconduct other than the charged offenses in the case were to be the subject of pretrial inquiry and a pretrial ruling on admissibility. I understand the court's concern that the specific admonition by the court was to any reference to any sexual misconduct by any witness. But I think it is perfectly clear that the parties understood at the time, and the judge's ruling makes clear, and there was no argument ever by the defendant in this case. Mr. Williams never contended in this case that he was not subject to or that he was not violating the admonition of the court that there should be no reference to any other uncharged sexual acts or sexual misconduct in this case. I think that was perfectly clear. If I've addressed the court's concern,
sure.
I mean the underlying point I want to make is everyone understood what the judge was saying, that there was not to be any other discussion, any other reference to acts of sexual misconduct. So even if I'm incorrect as to whether or not Mr. White was actually planning to be or would be called as a witness, the parties all understood what the judge's admonition was. And I simply want to emphasize, Mr. Williams has never argued in this case that the reference by him in his comment, the implication in his question to the victim, six-year-old victim's mother as to whether or not her boyfriend, the caretaker of the child, had ever in the past engaged in any acts of sexual misconduct with other children. There was never any argument in this case by the defendant below that this was in any way fell outside the court's admonition to the parties. So as I say, even if I'm right in my, even if I'm wrong, excuse me, in my recollection about precisely whether or not Mr. White had testified or was going to testify in this case, and thus would fall expressly within the admonition that there be no, the express language of the admonition, that there be no reference to any sexual acts by any witness, even if I'm wrong about that, the parties all understood that the judge's admonition at least was to all of the parties, let there be no reference by any witness in this case to other acts of sexual misconduct other than the acts that are charged, without an inquiry outside of the hearing of the jury on whether or not such evidence was would be admissible. And that clearly meant that the question by defense counsel of the victim's mother was in violation of the court's admonition. And it was understood by everyone below that that was it. And as I say, there has never been any claim by Mr. Williams to the contrary. So given that that was the setting in which this occurred, the question then becomes whether or not under the mistrial aspect of this case, which Mr. Deutsch has not argued here this morning, whether or not there was a manifest necessity for the granting of a mistrial. And we believe, for the reasons that we've argued, that there certainly was, that the judge fairly exercised the discretion that any trial judge must have in the face of an incident at trial where evidence that the court can fairly determine is highly prejudicial has been introduced, that the court here fairly exercised that very considerable discretion, which the United States Supreme Court in Arizona versus Washington has recognized the court must have, in fashioning an appropriate remedy. In this case, the court clearly believed, so stated, did not engage in a lengthy analysis, but I think it is readily inferable from the court's statement that it was the court's view that a curative instruction in this case would not have been a sufficient remedy, that there had been a significant, highly charged, highly prejudicial reference to unproven allegations of past misconduct by the child's caretaker, without any evidence, as the court's subsequent inquiry of defense counsel outside the presence of the jury revealed, without any strong evidence to believe that any such acts had ever occurred. And the judge ruled, that was part of the judge's ruling about why it was so prejudicial for the defense to have implied the existence of evidence that Mr. White had engaged in prior acts of misconduct, and then thus the prejudice of it mounted because it was the defendant's intention to suggest that because he had engaged in these past acts of misconduct with other people at some time in the past, and we know from the evidence that was brought forward that the defense was fishing for, didn't have firm evidence to support it, but was contending that there had been evidence that in the past he had engaged in sexual misconduct with some teenagers, not with a six-year-old child. But apart from the fact that there was no firm evidence for that, the implication was, of course, and this is what made it so highly prejudicial, that because he had done this unproven thing in the past, that suggested that with teenagers that he had molested a six-year-old child in this case, and that the defendant, Mr. Williams, was not the guilty party, but that Mr. White, the caretaker, was. It's because of that highly prejudicial suggestion in this case that the court, we think, fairly exercised its discretion in saying that the only appropriate, in its view, in this trial judge's view, the only appropriate remedy was the granting of a mistrial. We acknowledge that, and we think this is precisely what the Supreme Court said in Arizona versus Washington in upholding the discretion of trial judges when faced with these kind of incidents at trial. When the Supreme Court in Arizona versus Washington said that courts must have considerable discretion in fashioning remedies and that the court should show great deference to the determination of the trial judge on the time at the scene when the incident took place, that reviewing courts should show great deference to the judgment of trial judges when ruling on not questionably prejudicial incidents that occurred during trial that are outside the scope of fair presentation of evidence, but unquestionably improper and prejudicial information. Arizona versus Washington itself involved a highly prejudicial comment made by an attorney in argument to the court. We had here the practical equivalent of the same thing. Suggesting the existence of evidence, highly prejudicial, for which there was no genuine factual support, was highly prejudicial to the state by suggesting that someone other than the defendant had committed the act without any firm basis for it. Had Mr. Williams been able to present evidence that was relevant and material as to whether or not Mr. White had committed the crimes in this case, there's no question that we might very well have a very different case. The court would have been presented with an opportunity to say, all right, you're suggesting we do have evidence. There is evidence that can support this. Let's find out what it is here out of the presence of the jury. If the court was satisfied that such evidence existed, the court might very well have ruled, let's go back into court. I can fashion some sort of instruction and let the defense go ahead and present its evidence that Mr. White and not Mr. Williams committed the crime. But there was no such evidence.
Mr. Gansner,
yes.
Your recollection was correct. A Reverend Thomas White.
Reverend White.
Testified at the trial. Are there any other cases other than the 11th Circuit case in Humphrey that specifically hold that no presumption of vindictiveness arises when new charges are brought for a separate course of conduct that you know of?
Well, my research in this case did not reveal such other cases. And, of course, since this is a federal habeas corpus action under 2254, and the standard by which we are reviewing the state court of appeals decision was whether or not that decision was contrary to or an unreasonable application of controlling United States Supreme Court authority and not authority of the 11th Circuit, we have to make a decision, as the district court did, to determine whether or not under what everyone concedes, I believe, is the controlling authority that does exist, the material authority that is to be applied here, Blackledge and Thigpen, the question is whether or not the state court of appeals in rejecting the vindictive prosecution claim here unreasonably applied or acted in a fashion contrary to those two decisions. I don't know. My research did not reveal decisions other than the 11th Circuit's decision, Your Honor. It was our position in this case, as we've argued in our brief, that a presumption of vindictiveness did not arise in this case because under the teachings of Blackledge and Thigpen, a presumption of vindictiveness was held to have been found in those cases. The presumption arose in those cases because of the nature of the additional charges or the increased charges that were brought against the defendant after successfully obtaining a new trial. And in those cases, both in Thigpen and in Blackledge, what happened was that increased charges arising from the very same incident were brought against a defendant who had obtained a new trial. A misdemeanor went to a felony, or a lesser felony was upgraded to a more severe, a higher grade felony, for the exact same conduct that had originally been charged. In this case, what the State Court of Appeals held was that the presumption of vindictiveness that arose in that situation didn't arise here because the additional charges here, not upgraded charges, but additional charges that were filed here, were for conduct of the defendant that did not involve the victim for which Mr. Williams had been tried, found guilty, and then had obtained a new trial, arose out of conduct involving a different victim at an entirely different time. The only thing that was similar was the nature of the conduct, sexual molestation.
How old were the girls when they actually testified? I figured it was 12 and 13, was it?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. The it was the...
They were 5, 6, and 7 when the incident occurred.
Yeah, it's in 1990, and thus when they wound up testifying, and of course it's to be remembered that they testified twice. They testified in a in one trial.
The one that was reversed.
The one that was reversed, correct. And then they later testified in 2001. So there is that considerable time span involved here. So these were teenagers by the time that they testified. The in our view, if I just finished in one sentence, it was our view that no presumption of vindictiveness arose in this case, but that even if a presumption of vindictiveness could be said to have to arise out of these circumstances, that presumption was rebutted by the evidence that we believe clearly shows that the decision of the prosecutor to bring the additional charges was not designed to punish the defendant for having successfully obtained a new trial, but to prosecute the defendant for entirely separate charges that were supported by the evidence. And I realize I've turned that into one very long compound sentence, and I apologize, Your Honor.
That would be a wonderful test of your one's ability to diagram a sentence.
I think beyond my ability, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gaines. Mr. Deutsch.
Well, Your Honor, with regard to the some of the statements were made regarding the double jeopardy. First of all, we're not really convinced from the record that the defense attorney understood the instruction, the pretrial instruction from the judge about not being able to bring in testimony about the sexual conduct or habits of a potential witness. The reason that's unclear is when you read in the record and you see the defendant had a defense counsel had a chance to explain why he had asked that question, and he doesn't, his explanation, I mean, first of all, we weren't there, so we don't know, but it doesn't seem, his response doesn't really seem to jibe with what was going on. He says things like, well, I thought this question wasn't really about, the sexual history. This question was being related to the fact that why would she let this guy be around, and it doesn't really seem like he fully understood it, so I'm not so sure that that was fully understood. But second of all, it was raised that I have not discussed double jeopardy here to full extent because we felt the vindictive prosecution was more compelling at this point. But our point, and as it's thoroughly explained in the brief, is that the judge did not consider full alternatives. The most he says on the record is that at this point I see no other alternative but to declare a mistrial. Further, regarding prosecutorial vindictiveness, it was raised. It was said that that the Williams case isn't the same as Black Legend Thigpen because of the circumstance of when, because the additional charges didn't relate to the original allegations. And once again, response to that is what I'd said before, that the factual distinctions don't mean anything. The Supreme Court has never said that the idea behind Black Legend Thigpen does not apply to Williams' situation. It never precluded that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Deutsch. Our thanks to both counsel in the case. Mr. Deutsch, you serve by appointment of the court, and the court would like to extend a special thanks to you for having accepted the appointment and to your law firm for having expended so many resources on such a fine job before us today. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.